Translation: when Vasudeva heard that Nanda Maharaj, his very dear friend and brother, had come to Mathura and already paid the taxes to Kamsa, he went to Nanda Maharaj's residence. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki. Vasudeva and Nanda Maharaj were so intimately connected that they lived like brothers. Furthermore, it is learned from the notes of Sripad Madhvacharya that Vasudeva and Nanda Maharaj were stepbrothers. Vasudeva's father, Shirasen, married a Vaishya girl, and from her, Nanda Maharaj was born. Later, Nanda Maharaj himself married a Vaishya girl, Yashoda. Therefore, his family is celebrated as a Vaishya family. And Krishna, identifying himself as their son, took charge of Vaishya activities. Krishi, Goraksha, Vanijam. Balaram represents plowing the land for agriculture and therefore always carries in his hand a plow, whereas Krishna tends cows and therefore carries a flute in his hand. Thus the two brothers represent Krishi Raksha and Goraksha. Vasudeva Upasritya, Brataram Nandam Agatam, Gatvadatta Haram Ragye, Yayotad Avamochanam. When Vasudeva heard that Nanda Maharaj, his very dear friend and brother, had come to Mathura and already paid the taxes to Kamsa, he went to Nanda Maharaj's residence. Om Agana Chimarandasya Ganandina Shalakaya Chakshur and Melitam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadanti Kam Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhunachananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasati Gaur Bhakti Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. The famous author, whom you may know, George Orwell, Animal Farm in 1984. He was pretty spot on with 1984, except he was a few years out. I think Britain has got more cameras in it, watching us at every second, than any other country in the world. But he's quoted as having said, in a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. And I say, viva la revolution, long live the revolution. Bring on the truth, because we are strangling ourselves with our political correctness. Simply stated, animal slaughter means war. That's it. As Vaishnavas, whenever we hear the word abattoir, abattoir is a euphemism. A euphemism is a word that's used to disguise a more grotesque kind of a word. In America, they'll straight up tell you slaughterhouse, and that's pretty clear what that means. But over here, they say abattoir. It almost sounds like a monastery where an abbot would reside, you know, abattoir. But basically, it means the same thing. In the abattoir, stroke slaughterhouse, you have what's called the killing floor. And that's what they mean. When they say it's the killing floor, they mean it's the killing floor. It's the place where the animals are killed. I was thinking when I read this purport, Krishi Garaksha Vani Jam Vaisha Karma Sabhava Jam. This instruction is not just for Vaishyas in a Varnashram system. This instruction to protect the cows is for everyone. Why? Because the cow is religion and the bull represents Dharma. If you remember, when Maharaj Pariksit came upon the personality of Kali, a Sudra disguised as a king, now that's a whole discussion in itself. We could talk about that for the next 20 years without stopping. Sudra disguised as a king and all the different ramifications of, you know, the wolf in sheep's clothing and what that actually means. But when Maharaj Pariksit confronted Kali, what was he doing? He was beating the legs of a cow and a bull. Srila Prabhupada describes the cow and the bull as offenseless, defenseless creatures. Therefore, they require protection. In the Bhagavatam, it says that the human being is meant to be the big brother, i.e. the protector of all the other creatures. That means 400,000 species of life are meant to protect the other 8 million. And we're not doing a very good job. Animal slaughter has become institutionalized. Srila Prabhupada used to say, at least wait till the cow dies of natural causes. But no, now they've made it into a multi-billion dollar business. So You know, I did something about a year ago that I'd never done before. I stayed an entire day at the Goshala and got up really close with the cows and the bulls, and especially the bulls. And my observation was that after an entire day with them, they're like babies. They're like children. They're like little kids. If you look in their eyes, next time you go out in the Goshala, look in the eyes of the cow, look in the eyes of the bull. You'll see something that very closely resembles a small human child. They're innocent, they're fearful, and you can feel that they want you to protect them. They're looking for somebody to protect them. I was really touched by it, you know, because that's the first time I ever really spent that much time with them, especially the bulls. You know, they know when it's time to eat. They know when it's time. They know everything. As soon as the Goshala workers come and they fill up the troughs with hay, you know, the bulls are ready to just dash out like a child, you know, like an innocent child. And I was looking at them and I was thinking to myself, how covered over would somebody have to be to cut the throats of these offenseless, defenseless creatures? It'd be like murdering a human child, you know. But here, Srila Prabhupada is putting it almost on that same level, because the cows and the bulls are very dear to Lord Krishna. Chintamani prakara sadmasu kalpaviksha lakshavriteshu sudabhiyarabhipalyanta Lakshmi sahasratatasam brahmasevyamanam govinda maripurusham tambaham bhajami. In the Brahma Samhita, it's described that there are Sarabi cows in the spiritual world. What's the name of Krishna's planet? Goloka. The planet of the cows. That's what Goloka means. Go means the cows. Loka means the planet. Goloka, the planet of the cows. And Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur says, there are millions of them. And that gives us what Prabhupada used to say. He used to say, you can get an glimpse idea. That will give us an glimpse idea as of to the vastness of the spiritual world. We can't even begin to measure with mundane calibrations the infinite nature of the spiritual sky. It goes on forever, you know. Otherwise, how can you fit millions of cows in one place? With our little shopkeeper's imagination, we start to calculate, well, you know, so many meters here and so many meters on the other side, and you have to put up a fence, and, you know. No, it's not like that. It's unlimited and it's infinite. And Srila Bhakti Siddhanta, like Srila Prabhupada, if you remember, in the early days, the devotees kept coming to Srila Prabhupada, oh, Prabhupada, this management problem, this managerial problem, that managerial problem, you know, please help us with this. Prabhupada said, will you please learn how to manage this society? He said, my main work is translation, and I have to choose every word very soberly. And that's the same with Srila Bhakti Siddhanta. So when Srila Bhakti Siddhanta says, these cows are emitting oceans of milk, that is to be taken literally, not figuratively. When he says oceans, he means oceans. You know, take a ride down to Brighton. What's down there? The Atlantic Ocean. The cows in Goloka are emitting oceans of milk. Literally oceans. Now somebody might think, how can that fit into one little space? But we have to remember that Krishna is the infinitely infinite person who is infinitely conscious of infinity. Krishna creates infinity. We are infinitely insignificant. Our insignificance is infinite. The spiritual world just goes on forever, you know. There's no limit to it. You can't put up like perimeters and barbed wires and, you know, measure it, you know. It's beyond our comprehension. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta also mentions in the Brahma Samhita, he says, where is Krishna? He's in the fourth dimension. We don't know what the fourth dimension is. The pure devotee knows. We know length, breadth, and height, don't we? Because our senses are limited. But someone who actually loves Krishna, someone who has prema, by Krishna's grace, they can actually witness that kind of infinity. So I think it's pretty obvious that Krishna likes the cows because he creates millions of them. Millions and millions of cows running around Goloka. You know, I mentioned earlier that telling the truth is a revolutionary act. And basically what that means is that abattoir, slaughterhouse, means what? It means war. When we hear the word abattoir, right, we hear the word slaughterhouse, we should immediately think war. When we hear the word war, we should immediately think slaughterhouse. Those two are inexorably connected. I wanted to share with you a piece of a purport from the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam, chapter 26, I think text number 5. Prabhupada says, in this age of Kali, the propensity for mercy is almost nil. Come on, nobody likes anybody. You can feel it out in traffic. Everyone hates everyone. You know, sometimes I like you, sometimes I don't. Sometimes you like me, sometimes I don't. We all have enemies and supporters. Of course, that's a mundane consideration, isn't it? You know, the mundane consideration of friend and enemy. This is mundane duality. The Krishna consciousness process is meant to elevate our consciousness beyond these mundane calculations, beyond mundane duality, which means beyond the bodily conception, because that's where mundane dualities exist. They don't exist beyond the bodily conception, you know. So, Prabhupada says, consequently, there is always fighting and wars between men and nations. Men do not understand that because they unrestrictedly kill so many animals, they also must be slaughtered like animals in big wars. Take it from me. You do not want to see war. Because those of us who have seen war never stop seeing it. It plays over and over and over and over again in your head for the rest of your life. What you have to do is make friends with it. I, like a lot of my friends who had that experience, I'm still in counseling once a week. But where does it all begin? It begins in the abattoir. It begins on the killing floor. We were on Sankirtan once in America, and we met this fellow, huge fellow, about 6'7", 6'8". He was a Native American. And he was wearing one of those big hats that they wear sometimes with the feathers coming out the side. His hair was in a long braid. Real Native American guy, you know. And as it happened, he had bought some books in the past, and he was favorable to the devotees. He knew about Bhagavad Gita, and he bought some books from us that day on the street. But the interesting thing is that he was wearing these, you know, these rubber boots that the fishermen wear that come all the way up and cover your, you know, up to here? Waders, I think they're called. The trout fishermen use them. They go and they wade in the water so they don't get wet, right? Well, he was wearing those on the street. So one of the devotees said to him, why are you wearing those rubber boots that come all the way up and cover your chest? And he said, well, he said, I work in a slaughterhouse, and sometimes the blood gets pretty deep. And I thought, wow. You know, this is really, it's Kali Yuga. This is the age of Kali. Prabhupada says, men do not understand that because they unrestrictedly kill so many animals, they also must be slaughtered like animals in big wars. In another place, Prabhupada even mentions, he said, this includes the hunters in the forest. You know, there's this big hullabaloo going on about fox hunting, right? Did you ever see fox hunting? It's absolutely grotesque. I saw it a few years back when all the protesters were down at number 10 Downing Street. I don't know if you saw that on television, the anti-fox hunting people. They were fighting with the police, and the police were beating them over the head with truncheons. You know, it was extraordinary. And then they showed a film of a fox hunt. And this poor fox was being chased by the hounds, you know. And the fox went into a hole that had two entrances. It was one of those holes where you go in once down one end and come up the other side. So the dogs had cornered the fox. And some dogs had the fox by the tail on one end of the hole, and the other dogs had the fox by the neck on the other end of the hole, and they were pulling in opposite directions. So the fox was literally being pulled apart. You want to know why there's war? There are wars in almost every country of the world. You know, there's a war against the cows. There's a war going on against the bulls. You know, the human being who's meant to be the protector of the cows and bulls is waging war against the cows and the bulls. What does war mean? You conquer someone, you subjugate them, you dominate them, you make them your slave. You know, and in some cases, you eat them. There are certain tribals in different parts of the world who, you know, headhunters, they kill their enemy, cut off his head, and they eat his insides. And the reason they do that is so that his ghost won't come back to haunt them. It's been going on for ages. Everybody knows that, you know. Even in the so-called civilized world, if you've got the money, if you have enough money, go to New York, right? Search out what they call the black market. They call it the underground. And when they say underground, they don't mean the subway. They mean the black market. Right? If you know the right mantra, you can get human flesh. The correct mantra is long pork. If you go over there and ask for long pork, they'll provide you with human flesh. They'll tell you exactly where to go to get it. You know? There's a film that I'd like to recommend if you are so inclined and you have the time. It's called The Faces of Death. Perhaps you've seen it, parts 1 and 2. It really shines the light on meat eating, you know. When we use the term meat eating, usually people think of cows and bulls. But meat eating can apply to any of the 8,400,000 species of life, you know, including human beings. Prabhupada says here, this is very much evident in the Western countries. In the West, slaughterhouses are maintained without restriction, and therefore, every 5th or 10th year, there is a big war in which countless people are slaughtered even more cruelly than the animals. Now, define irony, okay? People kill the animals in the slaughterhouse, take them home, and cook them. Now, Prabhupada says, whoever has anything to do with it, they all get the same punishment. The person who owns the slaughterhouse, the person who gives the order to have the animal killed, the person who cuts the animal up, the person who wraps it up, puts it in the lorry driver takes it to the shop, right, Tesco's or wherever, you know. The person who comes in and buys it, the person who takes it home and cooks it, the person who eats it, they all get the same reaction, you know. Prabhupada used to give the example, supposing 3 men rob a bank, right? You have the person in the car, waiting out in the car, getaway car. You have another person who's watching to see if the police come. And you have the third person who goes in and actually takes the money. If the police catch them, they all get punished the same. Similarly with meat eating. Anybody who has anything to do with it, animal slaughter, they all get the same punishment. And it's pretty severe. If you read the 5th canto of the Bhagavatam, I mean, if you have any hair on your head at all, it's going to stand up straight. You know, what happens to people who engage in this way? You know, it says people who cook poor birds and animals alive, they have to go to a planet, I can't remember the name of it, Kumbhipaka or someplace like that. They go to a planet where they are boiled in oil by the Yamadutas for many millions of years. You know, this is serious business. Because the Krishna consciousness movement is not to be taken lightly. This is serious business, you know. And Prabhupada says this movement is the only way by which the demoniac qualities of the human beings can be destroyed. He says there's no other way. There's no other way. Prabhupada says here, in the West, slaughterhouses are maintained without restriction. Therefore, every 5th or 10th year, there is a big war in which countless people are slaughtered, even more cruelly than the animals. Sometimes during war, soldiers keep their enemies in concentration camps and kill them in very cruel ways. These are restrictions brought about by unrestricted animal killing in the slaughterhouses and by hunters in the forest. I mean, I just saw a film on Facebook the other day. These men were out hunting deer. And the big trophy is to find a male deer with the biggest horns, as many points on his horns as you can. You know, the male deer is called a buck. And they go out looking for, like, you know, a 13-point buck, 14-point buck. You know, and one man, they were laughing, these two men, they were laughing. One shot the deer from one side, and the other shot the deer from the other side, and they stood there and they laughed while the deer died. I thought, boy, the Yamadutas must be rubbing their hands waiting for you, mate. You know, it's grotesque, it's horrible. But this is, you know what it is? I'll tell you what it is. It's us being forced to look in the mirror, you know. Hide the human, bring out the beast, let all the animal games begin. It's in you and it's in me. You know, we have that tendency. You know, somebody might say, oh, Prabhu, I could never kill anybody. Oh, yes, you could. And if you had to, you would. If it was about survival. And that's what war is about. You know, war is not about, I know, because I've seen it. It's not about I shoot at you, you shoot at me, and then we call time out. No, it means 24/7, you know, 24/7, trying to stay alive. And the animals in the slaughterhouse, they have no chance. They can't fight back. That's why Prabhupada says they are offenseless and defenseless. I saw a great photoshopped picture on Facebook of a lion crouched behind a big boulder, holding a rifle. And the caption was, "Now it's even. Now it's fair." You know? Because you got, you know, what they call the big game hunter. You know, they go out with like 100 people carrying all these supplies, you know, and they're well protected and they hide behind the bushes. And the poor elephant, poachers, they're called poachers, aren't they? The poor elephant comes along and takes one right between the eyes. Bang! Down goes the elephant. Why? They want the ivory. They want his tusks. They want the ivory, you know. Shoot the lion. Why? So we can put the lion's head on our wall. Could you imagine a society of animals where, you know, they put human heads on the wall? You know, I mean, well, is it so far-fetched, really, if you think about it? You know, for every action, there's a reaction. What does the prefix R-E mean? In English grammar, the prefix R-E means again. For every action, there is a reaction. So there is an action followed by an action. You know? Those who are endowed with sufficient intelligence can see this, can understand this. But those whose consciousness has become very low due to sinful activities, well, they can't see the forest for the trees. You know? Prabhupada says, sometimes during war, soldiers keep enemies in concentration camps. Is the abattoir not a concentration camp for the animals? The slaughterhouse? It's a concentration camp. The animals are held. The pigs, right? The female pig is forced, you know, to have sex with the male pig, the boar, over and over and over again to keep producing children, you know, little pig babies over and over and over. Why? To satisfy someone's taste, someone's desire to eat flesh and drink blood. It's completely demoniac, you know. I think there's even a planet, a hellish planet, where people are forced to eat their own flesh. I forget all the details about that one, but I remember reading it in the Bhagavatam. A lot of people were saying when the fifth canto of Bhagavatam first came out, you know, it's also got that description of the universe, construction of the universe. They said this is going to, you know, either make or break devotees. And a lot of devotees, after they read the fifth canto, they left. They left the Krishna consciousness movement. And this is why many years ago when they went to Prabhupada and said, "Prabhupada, do you know that so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so have left our society?" And Prabhupada's reply was, "Don't be surprised who leaves, be surprised who stays." I'll tell you, Krishna consciousness is not for the faint-hearted. You know, this movement is not for the faint-hearted. This is for serious-minded people who want the genuine article of spiritual life. You know, this is not for tourists. Huh? The Krishna consciousness movement is not for tourists to come in and take a few photographs and go home. You know, this is serious business. Getting out of the material world. You know, it involves that the human being has got to become human. Is the human being human? Is what it's about. And the Vaishnava Acharyas in our line define for us what a true human being is. Prabhupada says here, "Proud demoniac persons do not know the laws of nature or the laws of God. Consequently, they unrestrictedly kill poor animals, not caring for them at all. In the Krishna consciousness movement, animal killing is completely prohibited. One is not accepted as a bona fide student in this movement unless he promises to follow the four regulative principles. No animal killing, no intoxication, no illicit sex, no gambling. This Krishna consciousness movement is the only means by which the sinful activities of men in this Kali Yuga can be counteracted." Prabhupada says in one place, you know, don't be so heavy on the people who work in the slaughterhouse, because we all have the propensity to be killers. Asurya namate loka andena tamasavritaha. Tamste pretya bigachanti ye ke chatma hanojanaha. The killer of the soul, atmaha, whoever he may be, must enter into the planets of the faithless that are full of darkness and ignorance. Now, the soul can't be killed. What gets killed? The opportunity. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is handing us a golden opportunity on a plate. The opportunity to taste vraj prem, as opposed to what? Drinking blood, eating flesh and drinking blood. A lot of people are now saying that World War III is imminent. That is just around the corner. And let's be honest, I don't think any of us, or even our whole movement, is going to shut down the slaughterhouse business, the abattoir business. It's too big. The animal rights lobby are trying like anything to like stop these things, but it's not going to work because the government actually supports animal killing. And, you know, if they support something, there's nothing you can do about it. All we can do is try and improve ourselves. We might be able to convince a few people to become vegetarians or maybe even become devotees, but we're not going to shut down the slaughterhouse industry. I tried it once. I don't know what got into me. We had a traveling party back in the 70s, late 1970s, with my old pal Jagat Guru Swami, whom you probably know, and me, himself, and about five or six brahmacharis. And we started a preaching center in St. Augustine, Florida. And, you know, we'd go out during the day, distribute books, do Harinam, invite people to come back to the temple in the evening, and we'd have a program. It was all right. It was nice. We had a Sunday feast. So one day I was thinking to myself, I could do something really dynamic, you know, really revolutionary. So I was looking through a magazine, you know, Karmi magazine, and I saw an article. I don't remember the name of the article, but I remember the caption. The caption said, "Blunders by Men Wearing Blinders." So I thought, ha-ha, I've got a wonderful idea. So I found a photo of slaughterhouse workers cutting up the animals, right? And I put that on one side, and on the other side, I put a whole explanation from, what's that, The Higher Taste. There's a lot of arguments in The Higher Taste book about why we should be vegetarians. I put that on the other side, and the caption over the top was "Blunders by Men Wearing Blinders." So I went and I had quite a few thousand copies made at the printer. And then I went out, and I started going from one McDonald's to the next. I'd stand in the car park at McDonald's. When the cars came in, I'd hand them one of these flyers, and I'd say, "Oh, here, we're having a special at McDonald's today." You know, and some people actually thought it was good, you know. I mean, why do people go to McDonald's? They want their burgers, you know. They want their flesh and blood. So I'm standing in the car park of McDonald's handing out these flyers with the picture of the men in the slaughterhouse cutting up the animals, "Blunders by Men Wearing Blinders," you know, and the explanation on the back from The Higher Taste. And I'm saying, "Yeah, we're having a special at McDonald's today." And I got away with it for a while, and then finally the security came out and chased me off. So I just went down to the next McDonald's, you know, down the motorway, and I started doing it there. I must have done about 10 different McDonald's. I got thrown out of every one, but I must have distributed a couple thousand of these flyers, you know. And then I went home and I thought to myself, that's not even a drop in the bucket. You think you're going to stop the slaughterhouse industry? You know? Even if war comes, people still don't get it. They still don't make that connection. They don't connect war with the abattoir. And that's what we as devotees have to do. You hear abattoir, you hear slaughterhouse, we should immediately think, war, this means war. Now, again, define irony. War, spelled backwards, is raw, R-A-W. So people kill the animals in the slaughterhouse, take them home and cook them. You know what's going to happen if war comes? People are going to eat whatever they can get their hands on, raw, just to survive. Our good friend Nostradamus, right, predicted, he said, World War III comes, he said, they will come to pluck the babe from the breast and they will eat the bark from the trees because there'll be nothing else. This is in the 12th canto of the Bhagavatam as well, the symptoms of the age of Kali. If we think things are bad now, I saw one of those DVDs of Prabhupada walking on it was a morning walk with his disciples many years ago, and they were discussing this issue, you know, the latter stages of the age of Kali. And Prabhupada says, the whole planet will be ablaze with fire. There will be no food. There'll be no water. They will eat their fathers and sons. If there's nothing else to eat, you know, years ago, wow. You know what? You ever hear this expression, silver spoon? And they'll say, oh, he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. She was born with a silver spoon in her mouth. So silver spoon means Janma Aishwarya Shruten Shri. Someone who's born in a high-class family with a lot of money, you know, beautiful bodily features, good education. From birth, they've had it all handed to them on a plate. So I heard this music track years ago called Silver Spoon. Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda Ki. Shri Shri Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Ki. Shri Shri Gauri Nitai Ki. Srila Prabhupada Ki. And it was all about, it had to do with what's going to happen, you know, if there's a war, right? And they said, it says, throw down your silver spoon. Pick up all the raw meat in your hands. Pick it up piece by piece. Pick it up piece by piece. Pick it up piece by piece. Where are the bodies for dinner? I want my food. Don't think it can't happen. Because that's what war is about. War is about survival. And then they say, this is really good. It says, what if you were starving to death and the only food you had was me? What would you say to the cannibal question? Would your answer be perfectly free? Your mama told you never to eat your friends with your fingers and hands. I say you better eat what you will, shove it in your mouth any way that you can. That time be's coming, my friends. I'm sorry to say, that time be's coming. Wow. A lot of memories are coming back now. I got pulled into the war in 1966, actually. And I worked in hospitals as a laboratory technician from about 66 to 72. This is during Vietnam time. And luckily, I wasn't on the front lines getting shot at. I have a really good friend who lives nearby who was in Tupara, the paratroop regiment of the British Army. And he served in Sierra Leone and Northern Ireland and I think the Falklands as well. And he told me some pretty serious things. So I was on the hospital end of it, you know. And we were trained in Fort Sam Houston, Texas, in San Antonio in America. Huge army base, huge army post. And thousands and thousands of military personnel everywhere. So we went to what was called the Medical Field Service School, where they train the field medics and they train the hospital personnel as well. You have to wear white, like white yogi pants and a white shirt. Hospital whites, hospital people wear white. So we used to have a break every afternoon from the school. They taught us hematology. They taught us about the blood, parasites, bacteria, urinalysis, serology, how to test all these obnoxious substances under a microscope. And part of our service was to make friends with the veterans, you know. We lived in a barracks with about 100 men, and across the pavement from us was another barracks, all the casualties. We used to come out and walk over to breakfast together in the morning, you know. First guy out the door is in a wheelchair, no legs. Second one, one arm, one leg, no arms, no legs, people severely burned. There's a hospital there called Brook Army Hospital, and they specialize in skin grafting. So, one day I went on a break. It was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I had a break from 1 to 2. So I went to the local cafe, and it was a big cafe. It had to be big when you have thousands of personnel on the same, on the one post, you know. And I went to the cafe, and I wasn't a vegetarian at the time, so you can imagine what I was having for lunch. Don't think about that. So I went and I sat down. I thought, wow, there's nobody here except me and the guy behind the till and a couple of kitchen workers. I got the whole cafe to myself. So I'm sitting there having my lunch. All of a sudden, door opens. In comes a fellow, soldier, about my age. I was 20 at the time, wearing a green dress uniform. He had all his stripes and all his medals. And I could see he had the rifle against the purple rectangular backing. It's called the Combat Infantry Badge, and it had stars on it. And each star represents how many hours you've actually been in the combat, you know. We didn't call it the combat in those days. We called it something else. That's what we called it. But anyway, you know, so I was intimidated. I thought, boy, he's really done something. I'm not doing anything. I'm just a stupid hospital worker, you know. Out of all the tables and out of all the places he could have sat, he comes and he sits right opposite me at the table I was sitting. I guess the poor guy wanted a friend or something, you know. And I was so embarrassed, I couldn't even look up at him. And I could feel him glaring at me, you know. So I was eating my lunch. Finally, I looked up. His face was completely gone. Had been completely burned off by something. And he was in the initial stages of skin grafting. Now, skin grafting is many, many, many operations over a long period of time. And I think he was just at the beginning of it. You've probably seen people around who've been severely burned. It's not nice. His face, irony, again, we're sitting there eating hamburgers, you know. His face looked like a piece of raw hamburger. And I just went, you know, and I froze. I was so embarrassed. I looked down again, and I just had to leave. I just walked out. I couldn't deal with it. I couldn't tolerate it. That was the last, I can't say that's the last time I ever saw him, because I see him every day of my life. I see that image. Where does all this lead back to? It leads back to the abattoir. It leads back to the slaughterhouse. That's where it begins. That's how people become like that. That's how people become like that. That's why soldiers go to war and get all cut and maimed and lose legs and arms and everything. Why? Because somebody has to have their meat. Kill in the slaughterhouse, be killed on the battlefield. It's as simple as that. That's our philosophy. That's what Prabhupada's teaching us. You know? What is a war? War means Krishna kills the killers. Krishna murders the murderers. That's what it's about. You know? So, wow. So many things. If someday we're all here in the temple and you hear a dull thud and you look out this window over here and you see a big orange mushroom cloud rising up in the sky, there's going to be a miracle here at the Bhaktivedanta Manor. You know what it is? We're all going to start liking each other. No more character assassination, no more stupid petty politics, no more making trouble for people we don't like. If somebody drops a nuclear warhead on the United Kingdom, we are all going to become the best of friends in 1 second. I've spoken to a lot of soldiers who fought in combat, and they all say the same thing. We did not fight for political ideology. We did not fight for the government. We fought for each other. And I can promise you something. If war comes to this country, each other is all we're going to have. I'm going to be watching your back, and you're going to be watching mine. It's going to be all about survival. All the politics is going to go right out the window. All the character assassinations are going to go right out the window. All this, I like you, I don't like you, you know, let's talk about something he did 30 years ago. We should know for a fact that to criticize a devotee for a fault that they no longer have is also Vaishnava Parad. All this gossiping that goes on. If war comes, it's going to end. I had a, back in the 60s, I had a really good wall poster that I bought. It was a painting done by a Frenchman. His surname was spelled P-I-T-R-E, but I don't think you pronounce the R-E. His name was Jean-Pete, you know? And he did a painting of an apocalyptic painting of, like, after the war, you know? And in the background, you see all these broken down, burned out, bombed out buildings. It's supposed to be New York City, because there's a little sign on the street, you know, just knocked down, says Fifth Avenue. That's New York. And in the foreground, you see this grass has come up, and the street have all merged together and formed a hill as a result of the bombing. And there's a concrete slab on the top of this hill. And he put his name on it, you know, Jean-Pete and company, implying that, you know, if war does come, even I am going to be, and my business are going to be destroyed. Standing on top of the platform is a man who looks like he's about 6 feet tall, wearing only the remnants of a pair of trousers, nothing else. Bare-chested, bare legs, bare feet. Big, powerful muscles, right? Real hairy-looking chest. Obviously, he's a survivor of this war. His hair's got real long, his beard's got real long, and he's looking straight out like this, you know, completely alert. That's what survival is about. If you're going to protect, if you want to stay alive, you better be alert and you better be awake. You better have eyes behind you, behind the back of your head, you know. And he's looking out like this. And his legs are real big and powerful, but very athletic and swift. That's what it's going to take to survive a nuclear war. You're going to have to be big, powerful, fast, swift, and intelligent. And you know what he's holding in his right hand? Remember the cavemen, the Stone Age? They're going to blast us right back into the Stone Age, if this ever happens, you know, forward into the past. You know, he's holding the elbow joint from underneath a sink, and it looks exactly like the weapons that the so-called Stone Age men used to use to kill. The title of this painting, A New Dawn. A New Dawn. Again, where does this all begin? It begins in the abattoir. It begins in the slaughterhouse. It starts with killing animals. As we kill the animals, so we will be killed. As you sow, so shall you reap. You know, so shall you reap. I wanted to recommend to you, I think I mentioned The Faces of Death earlier. It's a good film if you have the time. But there's another one we talked about at the Bhakti Center that I think really, really shines the light on what's going to happen if war comes as a result of all this animal killing. It's called Threads, Threads. It originally came out in 1978. It's a British film. And it's about what would happen if a nuclear warhead was detonated over the North Sea and the effect it has on the town of Sheffield. Everybody knows Sheffield, right? It's up north. First of all, and for 1978, the computer-generated images were very good. The first thing that happens is the wind created by this blast comes into Sheffield and cars, lorries, people are being blown around like matchsticks. You know, houses are being blown down to the ground. Then comes the heat. People, animals walking down the street, incinerated. They burst into flames just like that by the heat created by this nuclear weapon. And in the film, they said there was something like 88 tons of nuclear energy exchanged. It was the East versus the West. I don't want to say what countries because it's probably too political. You know, we'll all get in trouble. And no food, no water, no shelter. People were forced to eat the most abominable things, even each other. So if you have the time and you have the interest, you can find it on Google. It's called Threads. Came out in 1978. And if there is a war, believe me, everything will be just reduced to threads. There'll be nothing. And it's all a result of animal slaughter. All from animal killing. As I said earlier, believe me, take it from me. You do not want to see war. Because those of us who have seen it never stop seeing it. I saw a great film recently called Warsaw 1944. I like that word, Warsaw, saw war. And they did. It was about the German occupation of Poland in 1944. And, you know, Warsaw had a little People's Resistance Army. And, of course, the Nazis just came in and squashed them. They're waiting for the Russians. They're hoping the Russians would come in. But the Russians, for some reason, stayed on the outskirts of town. And Hitler's army just came in and completely squashed the rebellion, you know. But Warsaw was reduced to rubble. Complete rubble. There was nothing left. As was Dresden, the town of Dresden during World War II, reduced to nothing, you know. So the next time you hear about or think about an abattoir or a slaughterhouse, try to equate it with war, because those two things are inexorably connected. The one is the mirror reflection of the other. War is the mirror reflection of the abattoir. The abattoir is the mirror reflection of war. The two cannot be separated. That's the Vaishnav conclusion. Okay, we'll stop there. Anyone have any question or comment?